Good Thursday afternoon. May I be of the first to say good Thursday afternoon to you. We've got our relentless positive radio all queued up and ready to go. Focus with Paul W. Smith as you're on your way to making each and every day count. Each day is a gift, and I want to thank you for choosing to be an important part of the best and brightest audience in all of radio. We really appreciate it. The team is ready. They've been working all night to get the show ready. Well, Mike Parsons has been, our executive producer. Danielle Mason, making sure all the equipment is working. Somebody's got to do something about the Leaning Tower of the Fisher Building that if you're watching, which you can do if you're not driving, you can go to our Facebook or YouTube pages, and they're streaming our video live. But in the background, there's a Leaning Tower of the Fisher Building.
You know, and Paul, given... just snap your fingers.
Oh, it's gone.
Wow.
Did it fall?
The power was within you all along.
I love the Fisher Building, and showing it's great. And I have answered 14 million times, well, why do you call it the Golden Tower of the Fisher Building? That tower's green. Well, at nighttime, it's bathed in golden light.
Right.
Anyway, with the state of buildings falling apart, like in New York, we got to be real careful. People should understand, to the best of our knowledge, the Fisher Building is rock solid.
Right. It is upright, last we've checked.
It's built like a brick... spit
house.
A place where Graham Plattner hangs out.
Man, you're on a roll today.
Well, you want to talk about, and I watched it, which really is upsetting to me. A couple of things upsetting to me that I've fallen into. First of all, I had no idea until Graham Plattner straightened this out. It's everyone's fault but his own.
I heard the video was pretty, had a lot of self-pity and victim blaming in it.
He is the victim, not the people he raped, not the people he sent naked pictures or whatever they were of himself, not the women he busted up and manhandled. Don't make me go through the list, but what a piece of crap. And they knew it. But the thing that saved him, it's like what saved Kennedy when he killed a woman in Chappaquiddick. It's what saved all these guys is that they vote the right way. And he was their key to winning back the seat for the Democrats. And, well, and the only reason many of these Democrats now have found religion and are against him is because now the polls are saying he couldn't win.
Right.
Well, so now they're upset with all of the things they already knew about him. But I don't want to talk about that yet. Go ahead. What did you want to say?
I was going to say, it's interesting you say since he voted it's the right way, it saved him, because his latest accuser said that. She said she almost didn't want to come out with her accusations because she agrees with him 100% politically, and that she wants somebody like him in the Senate. Just not somebody.
Preferably not a rapist.
Right.
Or
just
an attacker of women.
Right. Just someone who didn't victimize her or other women.
Gee, I wonder if they're, you know, with everyone with toxic masculinity, I wonder if that man exists. Anyway, here's what I said. I don't want to get caught doing it. I'm doing it now. Right up until the show started. And now on the monitor, I'm watching that doggone trial. And this is the hearing to decide whether they go to trial or not with the Charlie Kirk murderer, alleged murderer. Even though he's on tape, they see him. It's him. We know that. Right. Anyway, here's what I didn't say yesterday, and now I have to say it. This judge, I just sense it. You know, I read people. I should get paid by lawyers that they hire all these big-time people that tell them who to pick, who not to pick for jury. I can do it in a second. And I can tell you this. Unless he proves me wrong, this judge, Tony F. Graff Jr., is not up to this big a trial. He is too careful, overly cautious. He is affected by the attention, and he's already making ridiculous cuts to protect the guy. Mm. And this whole Lance Twigg video, and I don't know if it's Lance or Amy. I'm not trying to make a point. I see his name two different ways. This Twigg guy, they have a video conversation. I don't know why it's on video.
That's the roommate, right, Paul?
Yeah, the lover. And supposedly this guy told the lover he had a chance to take out Charlie Kirk and he was going to do it. I mean, that's kind of important, don't you think?
Yeah.
They also have those in text messages between the two. So
well,
that's...
Do you have any idea why? It just occurred to me as we're talking about it. Why do they have a video of the two of them talking? Or is it because it was on like they were doing a...
I think that's the police interview that they did with him.
I see.
That's why it's on video.
Okay. All right. Oh. So Mr. Mrs. Twig said these things to the police.
Correct.
On video. And the judge is editing the video and won't even show the video. He's only going to play the audio. You know what? I hope and pray Tony F. Graff Jr. is not the next Lance Ito. Do you know who that is?
Yeah, he was the judge in the OJ trial.
Good job! And what were you, two? You might have been 2 years old.
I was in second grade, and for some reason
I knew
we watched...
That a two was coming to me.
You know what, Paul, for some reason, in elementary school, at lunch, they wheeled a TV in so watch the verdict.
Oh, no.
Which is kind of, looking back, is kind of weird.
It's sick.
Yeah.
I probably on the air in New York or Philly at the time, and I tried to, imagine how foolish this was after it all turned out. From the beginning, I tried to ignore it, which is what I'm trying to do with this one now, but I can't.
Yeah, I know.
I tried to ignore it, and I said, you can either, as a talk show host, ignore the O.J. Simpson trial or get run over by the speeding train that it represented. And I, at the last minute, decided to jump out of the way of the speeding train, and we had to talk about it.
I know.
Yeah, there's no way around it.
That happens to me a lot, Paul, too, when I'm going through with topics for the show and interviews. I'm like, I don't want to give that story oxygen. And then it's all everyone's talking about, and it's weird to ignore
it. You. Well, I'm happy to hear you say that, because that's the way you should look at these things. And sometimes we are pressed into talking about things we don't want to talk about. Like, I don't want to talk about Graham Plattner, the man who is held harmless by himself for all the things that happened to him. He is a narcissistic sociopath. And I love what Senator John Fetterman said. It's good to see the trash took itself out.
Yeah, strong
That's
statement.
It. The trash took itself out. All right, a couple of quick things. Sadly, Bonnie Tyler, the Welsh singer known for hits like Total Eclipse of the Heart and It's a Heartache. Do you guys know those songs?
I know. Total Eclipse of the Heart's a classic song.
Yeah, it is. Danielle, do you remember?
Yeah, I love that song.
All right. Well, she's died at 75. Well, I'm sorry. I didn't know I was breaking it to you for the first time.
I didn't know that. No.
Yeah, she died yesterday. And
she'd been in a coma for a while.
She was born Gaynor Hopkins, with a 3-time Grammy Award nominee, is made a member of the Order of the British Empire for her services to music in 2023. Her last releases were One World, One Home and Only Love, both released in April. 78th Annual Primetime Emmy Awards nominees were announced. One of them notably was Rob Reiner.
Right, I saw that.
Nominated posthumously. And then today, Argentina celebrates its 210th Independence Day, while the national football team, led by Lionel Messi, continues its successful World Cup 2026 campaign. The team, having won all 5 matches so far, will face Switzerland in the quarterfinals. Now here's another bad thing with me and my electronics and television. And I swear that the television is partly responsible, because I tried to tune in to the debate. And where I went for the channel, it said the debate is tomorrow. And I said, no, that's not true. But I said, record Republican debate into my little handheld thing. And it's nowhere to be found. And it was last night, and I missed it.
Yeah, so there was one last night on Fox. I think there's another one on tonight by Wood TV, I think. I'll double check that so people can tune in and watch it. But
I even threw in Wood TV into my request. It did not work.
But Fox is doing this thing I don't like with their debates. They're putting the first half hour on TV, and then the second half hour is on their streaming platform. And
that's ridiculous.
I think an important decision like governor shouldn't be used to build your streaming platform. It should be accessible to everybody.
Well, that's an excellent point. Well, I'm at a loss here, because I didn't see it. Did you see the debate? I did not see it.
The first half hour, yeah.
And you didn't switch over to the other thing.
It was spirited, I will say that.
Well, I mean, look, if I had to, how do I say this? I'll say it in general terms. If I had to face two other people, which is there are three people in the debate, two other people, who've been spewing the information they've been spewing on television commercials, I don't know how you stay civil when you run into those two people and are supposed to have a civil debate.
Right.
Was it civil?
I mean, they weren't throwing punches, but they were going after each other for sure. And Perry Johnson kept yelling in the middle of people's answers.
Well, here's something else that's not attractive. Reading in the background, in a moment, Nicole Matthew, Oakland County political science professor, will be here to talk about it. She'll give her take on all this. But did Perry really start saying things like, I'll bet you $5 million if you blah, blah, blah.
I think that part came during streaming, but I think it was John James saying something about it. He goes, I never did that. And poor Roop's trying to keep it under control.
Well, Roop Rogers, great. I love him. I can't believe I missed the whole thing. But I'll bet you $20 million. I mean, these are arguments that most of us don't get into.
Yeah, not the most relatable retort.
No. No. I saw Brian walk in. Hello, Brian. All right.
He's waving.
Okay. All right, we're underway. It's going to be a spirited, relentless, positive radio presentation. Focus on WJR. Quick change-a-roo on the music there. I was just getting the beat. You know, that music is important. We call it bumper music. Well, accusations of outsourcing, lying, losing, desperation, and what one candidate described as, quote, magic numbers, that was all flying last night at the debate featuring the three men who hope to be the Republican nominee for governor this fall. That would be, of course, former Attorney General Mike Cox, United States Representative John James, and businessman Perry Johnson. Now, I am thrilled, more than you can imagine, to have Oakland University political science professor Nicole Matthew with us. Professor Matthew, welcome to Focus with Paul W. Smith. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I have to come clean right away. First of all, my dog did not eat my homework. I don't have a dog. But I did succumb to operator error. And when I thought I was recording the debate, I did not. So I come to you like most of the people listening to us right now. I didn't see it at all. So we're going to depend on you to tell us how it went. How did it go overall as a useful source of information?
Well, honestly, I don't think you missed a whole lot. This candidate spent about the first 45% of the debate arguing about who outsourced what, who took money from MEDC. No one even explained what MEDC is. Perry Johnson bet someone $5 million that they were wrong about a claim.
We talked about
a little bit tone deaf to be making a $5 million bet.
We talked about how not terribly relatable to the average person watching. Yeah, I'm sorry I missed that. That had to be wild. Okay, so it was a mishmash. I said earlier, honestly, Professor, it takes a lot of stamina, courage, I don't know what, to stand in the same room with somebody who said the things about each one of these guys that have been out there on television commercials. I mean, that's just crazy. But be that as it may, do you feel there was a winner?
Well, I said earlier today, I think Roop Raj, the moderator, was the winner. He interrupted them all and said, you know, the people don't want to hear about all these complaints you have about each other. They don't like the bickering.
God bless Roop Raj.
They really toned it down after that and focused more on just answering the question and not attacking their opponent. But what really surprised me is how little talk there was about attacking Gretchen Whitmer, attacking Jocelyn Benson. You know, there was really not much thought to the general election at this event.
Interesting. I think it's because, and I have been told, by those who watched it, that Representative John James was the target of both Mike Cox and Perry Johnson. And that's only, I guess that's the way it goes when you have been picked as the leader of the pack. So they're all going to go attacking him, trying to break him down to put themselves in a better position. I mean, I guess that's what happened.
Yeah, I mean, he's the front runner because he's the most recent office holder, but he didn't come out of the gate as strong at the beginning of the campaign as people anticipated. And I think that's kind of left the door open for these other candidates. But to me, it seemed like they're all trying to still get Donald Trump's endorsement. They're relitigating the 2020 election. They're not really focusing on things that are going to be mattering in a couple months.
Things that we, the people, actually care about. I can't believe they fell into the 2020 trap. My goodness gracious. There was some talk about something was written on Mike Cox's hand. And in black ink, the newspaper today saying it appeared to be John James made in China. Like that might have been a line he wanted to remember to use, but he claimed that when he was leaving his office, his assistant gave him a list of stuff or told him stuff she wanted him to order, like at Staples or someplace, and that he had written on his hand the list of things that she needed him to pick up. I don't know, and I don't
buy that. I find it a little suspect that his assistant is telling him to buy made-in-China products.
Yeah, I don't think that's what really happened there.
I don't remember him landing a made-in-China argument. I remember him saying that James had imported products from, I think, Japan, he said. But that wasn't a major factor in the debate, so I think maybe he forgot to look at his hand.
Mm. That's hilarious. He got off and he looked at his hand and goes, oh, how can I forget this? The other one is apparently they were saying that John James was a trust fund baby. I don't know when that became negative, but I don't know about you, Professor. I would have loved to have been a trust fund baby. What, am I going to lie? Here, Paul, here's $100 million upon our death. Have a good life. Why would I complain? I don't know.
Right.
Anyway, anything? You're very good at this, and I appreciate you going through this. Anything else on your mind about the debate last night?
Well, I just hope that tonight's debate, if people watch it, they get a little more out of it.
Is this the same guys debating again?
Yes, same candidates, different TV stations.
Why in the... Okay, well, at least maybe I've got a thing I got to go to tonight. If I try to tape it, I'm sure I'll screw it up again. I want to watch it. I do. And boy, it'll be totally different given what they now know the other guys have as ammunition. They're going to be ready for it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and hopefully they don't make the notes on their hand this time.
Yes. Could you, from what you watched, Professor, could you pick someone that you would back based on what happened last night?
I don't think so, because they didn't really talk that much about their issues. I think, John James looked the most poised, and I think he made a good point that Mike Cox hadn't won an election since 2006. That was a long time ago. So he looks more like the front runner. But he did lose his cool for a second and complained about all the BS they're throwing at him and compared himself to Jesus. And I don't know if that's what he was really going for.
He compared himself to Jesus?
Well, he said that the two other candidates would find some reason to criticize Jesus for walking on the water.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. Well, that's a little different. Yeah, and it's probably true. We see it in politics every day. And right now it's with Trump derangement syndrome. You can dislike him, but if he did come up with a cure for cancer, they would find a reason to complain about it, it seems, because it's tied into Trump. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oakland University political science professor Nicole Matthew, class is dismissed, and thank you for not giving us any homework.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Professor. We continue in Focus at 12:31 on WJR. Dr. Frank Richter, PhD, former advisor to Saudi Arabia on Mideast terrorism, Iran and Israel, and all the things that they've been going through all of our lifetimes. U.S. carries out more strikes against Iran as President Trump declares ceasefire over. I guess certainly we on this program knew that there was never going to be a successful ceasefire. And frankly, I'll go a step further. There's never going to be a successful agreement. Iran lies. They will lie again. And then they'll do whatever they need to do or want to do. Why do you think the president is tiptoeing around this so much? Is it that he's worried about his place in history? He truly doesn't like war? Or he actually has humanity that some people don't think he has, but I kind of think he does, that he worries about the innocents that would be killed if Iran keeps doing what they're doing. What do you say, Dr. Richter?
Well, President Trump is not really the problem. His problem in the sense that he started the war, but the negotiations have gone poorly and the memorandum of understanding has virtually torn up because both sides, United States and Iran, have a history of, and it's well known around the world, of not being good and to be trustworthy in negotiations. The United States has backed out of several treaties with Russia, anti-ballistic missile treaty, transatlantic Pacific partnership, and so on. And Iran's just as bad. And so when you get both of these who don't trust one another, the old saying is trust but verify. Both U.S. and Iran don't trust one another, and they're concerned only about verification and their point of view.
So does this end only with the obliteration of Iran? How does something like this ever really end, Professor?
Well, I would argue that it's not really about obliterating Iran or obliterating the oil infrastructure of the Gulf states. That's what everybody on both sides of the Gulf, including the Iranians and the U.S., are trying to avoid because they've cut their own throats. This ceasefire is about money, not about killing people. There's been something like 14,000 sorties, that is air missions by Israeli and American airplanes. In that time, 4,000 Iranians have been killed, half maybe government and fighters, but 2,000 civilians have died in over 100 days among 93 million people. That small percentage number per 100,000 of people killed is approximately the same as the number of Iranians who have died in traffic accidents over the last 3 months. And in the previous exchanges with Israel and Iran in missiles and drones have killed only handfuls of people, at least in Israel. And even now, the Gulf states only have some almost single figures of people, the six Gulf states, killed by Iranian drones. This is not about killing a lot of people. It's about the money and the blockers of the Strait of Hormuz and reparations that Iran wants. It's about money, not people.
But if the president, I mean, he has said, I think, far too often, well, you better watch out. We're really going to hit you hard now. He can't keep saying that and get away with it. He's unfortunately going to have to do it. And if he does it, then many, many more people will die than the ones that you've, those are small numbers in the scheme of things. Never good, but smaller numbers than one might have expected. But eventually, doesn't he have to really come through on this?
Well, wars have a way of expanding out of control. That hasn't happened yet. And you and I talked about this in the past. Why is Trump going back and forth on all these things? And part of it is this idea of the madman approach to negotiations. Nixon had it somewhat with the North Vietnamese. You want to be unpredictable. You want your enemy to think that you are a madman. And the other reason is things have gone back and forth is that the stock market has gone up and down in oil prices and so on, and somebody is making money on this. Either people that Donald Trump knows or people that the Iranian Revolutionary Guards know, Islamic Guards. The unpredictability of it is correct, and it can expand. But that would explain why there's not been a steady path to peace in the last 3 months.
This is one of the very issues we brought up a few times here in the afternoon. To watch the oil go up and down, to watch the stock market go up and down, and to realize there are people who are making hundreds of millions of dollars on this. And, man, I sure hope we don't ever find out that they were able to get inside information and trade on that, because that's going to destroy our faith in our government if that ever turns out to be true. Do you think that's a possibility, Dr. Richter?
It's going to be difficult to prove because our Justice Department and Security Exchange Commission are controlled by the Trump administration and the people around him. He's not going to be investigated unless the Democrats take over the House and or the Senate in the midterms. And we already are worried about the stock trades that the president has. But I'm emphasizing it could also be on the part of the Iranians. They're making, as you point out, hundreds of millions of dollars by knowing what they're going to do in the next few days and how it's going to affect the world markets on oil. And people are making money. As I said before, this is about money. It's not about obliterating the people on both sides of that Persian Gulf.
Well put. I never even considered the Iranian enrichment from those up and down markets. So that's why we have you on, because you're so good, Dr. Frank Richter, Ph.D., former advisor to Saudi Arabia on Mideast terrorism, Iran, and Israel. Thank you, Doctor. Always nice talking with you.
Thank you, Paul.
1243 at WJR. Our next guest has been all around the world and is called upon all around the world for his expertise in medicine, healthy living, and such. He is Dr. Tom Rafai, MD, FACP, DIP, I don't know what this one is, DIP ABLM, most importantly, President and CEO of Reality Meets Science Incorporated, past president of the U.S. National Board of Physician Nutrition Specialists, all of that. And we talked to him not often enough, but maybe now that he's back in the area, we'll get him on more. That this latest study out that shows glucosamine supplements have been linked to faster Alzheimer's progression. That got some people's attention, Doc. Hi.
It's wonderful to be back with you, Paul W. The DIP ABLM is a diplomate of the American Board of Lifestyle Medicine.
All right, good.
Now, let's get right down to this study and not bury the headline. The relative increase in progression from mild cognitive impairment to mild dementia was 5% versus 6.25%. That's an absolute risk increase, the relative risk increase of which is 25%. So the media, and often we tend to report these relative risks that make things look bigger than they really are. So imagine 5% versus 6.25% over 5 years. And it was an observational study. So it was a retrospective analysis of University of Florida health records. And as you know, because we've spoken so many times, the only way to really prove something is a human randomized controlled trial where you control everything from the beginning, you know what your goals are, and then you follow. Obviously, if it's a massive increase in relative risk, like smoking, we don't need a randomized controlled trial to prove smoking causes cancer or that jumping out of a plane without a parachute will kill you. Well, I guess most of the time. But in this case, there's a signal, and it's of note because of a couple things for me. Number one, I've been very picky about glucosamine supplements. I know in the past you've called me out for not being forward enough about specific brands. And I must say, before I mention this one, I have no financial relationship to the only brand that has been studied in randomized controlled trials. And it is a prescription form in Europe that, due to our 1994 Dietary Health and Supplement Act, we can buy over the counter here. And this form of glucosamine or crystalline glucosamine sulfate is called DONA or D-O-N-A. And it has been studied in multiple randomized controlled trials in the thousands of patients and shown to have some possible even rebuilding of cartilage and reduced symptom. So I don't recommend any other type, but I must say that, you know, the overall benefits rather mild, and, you know, the evidence of losing 5 to especially 10% in a healthy way of body weight has much better evidence for improved symptomatology of knee osteoarthritis.
So bottom line here, Dr. Rafai, since we don't know the whole truth and nothing but the truth, regarding glucosamine supplements linked to a faster Alzheimer's progression. If you are taking glucosamine and getting relief, you should probably just continue to take it. And by the way, if you're taking any medicines that a doctor has prescribed, you never stop taking those medicines without a discussion with your doctor. That still stands true, yes?
What 100%. I mean, if another licensed healthcare provider comes in and there's some new history, your doctor doesn't know and says, stop it, that's fine. But you still go back and tell your doctor and coordinate with your doctor. Now, so a licensed healthcare provider should be the one that's directing on that based on history. And yes, the other point of it is correct. If you've been using glucosamine and it has been improving your physical activity, which we know is huge, like the drug in and of itself, you stop it, your symptoms come back, you're no longer walking as much. That's not really a net benefit for you at all. So if you feel it's been giving you a benefit, you really need to talk to the best in the best context, which is you with your licensed healthcare provider that knows you the best. I just note that when you look at the best data, the largest groups, whether it's for osteoarthritis or rheumatological associations, don't recommend glucosamine because when they look at all of the studies, but when you look at the one type that has been studied in human randomized controlled trials specifically, it does tend to work. That's the one that I recommend. I'm not going to mention it again. You can if you like, but again, I have no financial relationship to the company.
I've never heard of it. Dona. I've never heard of it. But anyway, you know, we're learning every day the art of practicing medicine. It is an art. It is not just a science. And there are differing views, differing opinions. I want to ask you a couple of quick questions with quick answers. Is there a test we all should have, say, anybody at 40 or 40 and above, is there some kind of a test that you say we should all have and maybe not getting?
Yes, one of them for sure, and then arguably could be, you know, at any age, even 10 and above, is a specific form of cholesterol that is so common in the human race, 1 in 5 humans has an elevated level, 1 in 10 has a very high level, and it is not detected by a standard cholesterol test. It increases not only the risk of heart attack and stroke, but aortic stenosis, and it is called LPA, or lipoprotein little a, is its old long name, literally spelled with a parentheses, little a, close parentheses, but every doctor knows what an LPA is. The new guidelines say everyone deserves at least one in a lifetime check, Canadian guidelines, Indian guidelines, Saudi guidelines.
All right.
And we have probably checked 1% of us in the United States.
All right, quickly. I don't know if this is the name or not, but online, and I'm sure that social media online has been a boon and a problem, but is it called a methylation test where you take a swab in your mouth and you mail it in and they tell you whatever you're deficient in? Is that what that's called?
Kind of- There's methylation tests, there's biological clocks. All of these tests, though, have not been studied in outcome studies, right? We have to be careful that, Paul W., your blood pressure, your cholesterol, including this LPA test, which you need to add to a regular test so you know both, and, of course, what I would call your blood sugar insulin sensitivity. Those three, your blood pressure, we need to check at home. What you're seeing in your doctor's office is okay, but many people have a higher level in the doctor's office than out, and some All W have a lower level. We saw one patient with 110 in the office.
We're going to have to run.
160 at home.
Clock is running out, Doc, but we'll have you back. Dr. Tom Rafai on WJR. Hour number two of Focus here on WJR, where you can tune in at 760 on the AM dial while you're going from here to there and on your way to making each and every day count, because each day is a gift. And by the way, thanks for choosing to be an important part of the best and brightest audience in all of radio. That happens when you tune in to WJR. Whether you're streaming us at WJR.com or coming back and podcasting us at WJR.com. And also be sure you get the free WJR app. You know, the team is here. Mike Parsons, Danielle Mason, Rich Lucinski. I wanted to ask Dr. Rafai. There's always questions with every guest that I never get to. Time runs out. I wanted to talk about something that's actually being talked about online right now about taking too many vitamins.
Mm.
I might run the risk of taking too many vitamins. I take handfuls of vitamins when I go to bed.
Well, you need to read the label. I know that. I don't know if you're supposed to be pounding them like candy.
Well, I pound them almost like candy. Now, my nose was not acting up for the first part of the show. Now it's starting to.
Need more vitamin C and vitamin D supplements, I guess.
I'm taking vitamin D. I'm taking vitamin C. You can probably come up with 10, 15, 25 things. I'm taking them. We'll get into that about too many vitamins. I'm a big believer in vitamins, but I think there can be, quote unquote, too much of a good thing, and I don't know yet. That's right. What I was getting at with that test. I see they talk about it online. It says if you take that test, it's like $500 or $600 that you take that test, you'll know what you're deficient in, and for the rest of your life, supposedly, those are the only vitamins and supplements you should take because that test shows you're deficient in them. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know.
I mean, if you have the $500 to $600, it might be worth it, but that's a lot to pay for a test.
It is a lot. Did we see, I see you have it on my list of things, of topics and such, but printed that down. Yeah, did we see why the Secret Service, everyone was talking about why didn't the president take off from Turkey on his big, beautiful, brand new jet? And the headline from ABC says, Secret Service urged Trump to use old Air Force One as a security precaution.
Well, if you ask President Trump, first he said that he was sending it to military base in England.
So they could see it.
Right. But then he finished the sentence saying, well, I'm number one on Iran's kill list. And it's like, wow. It's almost like taking an airplane from a foreign entity was a bad idea to begin with, because I don't see that changing. I don't see him getting off of Iran's kill list. So does that mean that they're not going to use the new Qatari gifted Air Force One now?
Yeah, but how would you like to be the people on that new Air Force One realizing that the Secret Service might have sent you out as a decoy to be shot down with them thinking the president's on it?
Right.
Hey, wait a minute. Why did we have to leave early? I mean, they aren't Secret Service. They didn't sign up for that.
Hey, wait a second. I'm starting to think they're not sending us to England to show the soldiers this plane at all.
Boy, I don't know what it is. I don't.
But yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Everyone thought, well, not everybody, a lot of people were saying that it was a bad idea for the president to take an airplane that was gifted to him by Qatar, a foreign country. I know we're friendly with them, but they were saying it was a bad idea to not have the new Air Force One built in America. They had to take it. They had to retrofit it. They had to look all through it. And even after that, they still thought it was too dangerous to send the president home with it.
I don't understand. Unless there is some kind of technology they had not yet gotten onto the new plane, missile avoidance technology or something. Don't know. I don't know if we'll ever find out. But I will say this. Here's the big question I've not heard anyone talk about. I have no problem with him snoring his way into a new plane. What I don't understand is how no one is saying anything about the fact that, as you mentioned, they had to retrofit it. In fact, as I understand it, they took it down to the nuts and bolts.
Right.
Where if it were a house, they took it down to the studs.
Right.
And checked everything and then redid it all so that it would be what it had to be. What I do not understand is how is it then with United States taxpayers' dollars to fix that jet to make it appropriate for a president, why in the world is it following him out of office and will be then taken out of service in, what, 2 years? I don't know when they have a... It'll go to his presidential library. Why?
Right.
Why would we take it, after spending presumably hundreds of millions of dollars to get it ready, why would we then stick it in mothballs in a library?
Right. It's almost like they're renting it for the remainder of Trump's term, and then they're going to go back to the old Air Force One. That's a good question.
Well, no, they're not going to go back to the old Air Force One. What they're doing is they're waiting for two new Air Force Ones to be built. I understand that. That's good. I mean, these planes are 45 years old, and sadly we fly on 45-year-old planes, but the president wants the newest, latest, and greatest, and should have it. I agree. But the idea that for whatever reason, when he leaves office, it goes with him to his library. I don't.
Yeah.
Nobody's saying, well, wait a minute. we spent hundreds of millions of dollars to retrofit this plane so it can be an Air Force One. Why doesn't it stay in the presidential Air Force One fleet?
Right. Yeah, it seems like a big waste of money.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it shouldn't end up that way, but that's what it sounds like. Charles Barkley reveals why he skipped the Taylor Swift Travis Kelce wedding. Did you read what that was?
Yeah, he said that he doesn't go to weddings and that he thought it was going to be a big crap show, so he wanted to avoid it.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. I didn't hear that part.
Good for him.
You know, in the old days, didn't go to funerals. Mm. He said he didn't go to weddings or funerals.
Oh, okay.
And I had trouble with funerals for a lot of reasons. But once you lose people and the funeral is for someone very important in your life and you're at that funeral and then you see the people who come to pay their respects, they're coming for you,
right?
Not for the dead person, obviously. And I realized how helpful it was for the people who came to my brother's funeral, my dad's funeral, my mother's funeral. I realized just how significant it was to me.
Paul,
now I go to funerals.
You're 100% right, and that's what happened to me. I used to not go to funerals. Like, I didn't really know the person who passed away. You know,
right.
I'm not going to it. But, yeah, people who went to my dad's funeral, my sister's funeral, I remember every single person who came to of the viewing or the funeral, and you're absolutely right. Those people are there for you, and, you know, even the people who surprised you that showed up. I mean, these people, because, you know, funerals are short notice. I mean, someone passes away two, three days later is the memorial. Right. And, not only did they show up, they showed up on short notice. So I'm like you. I've been going to funerals and viewings as much as I
now.
Could. Yeah.
Much more now.
If I can make it, even if for 5 minutes, I still go out.
Yep, we've had the same, you know, that's what life experience is all about. We've had the same kind of similar life experience, and I urge people to double think that. But a lot of people go. I mean, Ann Thomas and Ed Battersby, the barrister Battersby, they are very good at going to funerals. I joke with them that they have their funeral clothes in the trunk of their car and they're ready to go at any moment.
A duffel bag.
Yeah, a duffel bag. But, they're just, it's very soothing, very helpful to people. All right, quickly, White House announces the first Freedom Fuel Station selling gas at $3.47 a gallon. Where?
Your old stomping grounds, Paul.
Philly.
Philadelphia and New Jersey. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that means the White House is actually opening gas stations or what, but hopefully they expand them because I'd pay $3.47 for gas.
$3.47, wow, that's good. Yeah, let's hope it catches on. Not likely, given the fact that we're about to go, supposedly, back to all-out war. Lots more to talk about. One of the best to talk about anything is up next. Patrick Anderson, founder and CEO of Anderson Economic Group. Stay with us. Patrick Anderson, founder, CEO of Anderson Economic Group, joins us. Patrick, always a pleasure. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you.
No surprises here. Oil prices rose yesterday. The stock market dropped. All of this on news of the ceasefire ending. This has been a roller coaster. Yeah, I haven't seen what's happening today. Do you know offhand?
Yeah, I mean prices are the oil prices are higher, but they dropped in the last couple hours. I mean, but it's a situation where we went from a war and shooting at tankers to an agreement, not a treaty, just a temporary memorandum of understanding, and now the president's saying somewhat laconically he considers it over. As literally as ships are burning and as missiles are flying. So it is definitely over if you are looking at it in the normal way you would look at it, a memorandum of understanding, especially one that has a specific paragraph that says we'll have free movement of ships through the Straits of Hormuz.
So clearly some people have made hundreds of millions of dollars on, I'm going to hope it's just betting on one way or another and the timing of what's going on. I pray we're not going to find out that people had inside information and used all of these ups and downs, and there have been so many of them, with the whims and decisions being made in this so-called war.
I sure hope so, but I will say it's not as if this is easy stuff to trade, and you can sit in your basement and all of a sudden buy a tanker and then sell it tomorrow. this is, you know, I haven't done that. I mean, these are all kinds of really specific types of oil. Dubai crude, Indian basket crude, Mexican basket crude, WTI crude and Brent crude. And, you know, the ones to look at, of course, WTI is West Texas Intermediate. So I always look there because that's basically American crude. And then Brent crude means the price typically that Europe is paying. And the Brent crude right now has opened up quite a big increase, which shows, I mean, basically you can look here, it's over $4 a barrel difference. Essentially that is $4 a barrel because the United States has done a great job of becoming almost energy independent, whereas Western Europe has not done a good job and actually made themselves more energy vulnerable.
You know, you say almost energy independent. We were being led to believe that we were energy independent. We also were led to believe that oil moving in and out of the Strait of Hormuz would really not be oil that we were needing and wanting, but the rest of the world. But how could this war, firing back up again, affect the world's oil supply once again? Or did enough ships get through for the minutes seemingly they were allowed to get through there that we can hold off some problems for a while?
We're not holding off problems for very long. Our stockpiles are down. Our strategic petroleum reserve, which the Biden administration drained a lot out of in the hopes that it would hide the inflation that was hitting oil prices, is now lower. So we're not completely energy independent. We are very insulated compared to Western Europe. And I give all of our friends working in oil and gas, as well as the people who were policymakers that made it easier for us to drill and refine here in the United States for that. But we're not completely insulated. And when you have so much of the world's oil going through one place and you have a combatant in a hot war shooting at those ships, you are, in fact, going to have price spikes, difficulty in getting supply. That is going to affect the United States, but much, much more affecting other countries.
Patrick Anderson, founder and CEO of Anderson Economic Group. What do you think is going to be happening as a lot of people are taking a look at the Federal Reserve and wondering what their next move would be? What would you like it to be?
I think this Federal Reserve under the new chairman is doing exactly what they should. I was quite impressed with how Kevin Warsh had handled his first meeting. He said exactly the right number of things and exactly the way that he should. He's cutting back on some of the excessive rhetoric and a little bit, I'll say, of showboating that was happening. And he's indicating a strong direction. Now, right now, the president's giving him lots of room, say, okay, you're the new person, you need to get a handle on this. But while we have this kind of pressure going on with oil prices, it's going to be really hard to reduce rates. So I'm not expecting we're going to see any rate reductions anytime soon, despite the fact that this Federal Reserve chairman and a lot of other folks would like them to go down.
I give Kevin Warsh a lot of credit. I don't know him at all, have never heard of him, never followed him, blah, blah, blah. But what I did expect was, after watching what the president had done with the last Federal Reserve chairman, I give Kevin Warsh an award for great intestinal fortitude to not feel pressured into lowering the rate because he knew the president desperately wanted him to do that.
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons you and I are on the same page again. He did his job. If you're a Fed chairman, number one part of your job is maintaining the independence and credibility of a Federal Reserve system. That's to the benefit of the entire United States and much of the world, and that means you are going to be in a collision course with people running for office or people who are political appointees. That is a certain, and you need to stand up and articulate that your job is to keep inflation down, not to increase the chances that people from one party or another get elected in the next election.
Well, and frankly, I mean, personally, I want them to lower rates because I'm trying to sell a house, and it's much more difficult given the market and the interest rates and everything else. But I understand he's doing what he believes, and apparently you, Patrick, believe is the right thing. So that's the way it is. That's the way we look at it. Anything else we need to know, Patrick?
Well, it's still much better to be in the United States than anywhere else.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I was lamenting.
You and I have this discussion.
Yeah, I'm going to say it again, though, because there are so many people, many Democrats, many liberals, many kids, who just don't get it. I thought for sure they'd learn something from all the people coming into America for the football, for the World Cup. They love America. They can't believe we are as good as we are as a country and as a people. And they say they were fed a bunch of malarkey from the world news media, and they have. You would think that some of that would capture the attention of these people who aren't proud to be an American, who don't think or hope that America will be here in 250 years. I mean, I told the story in my Detroit News column, I think I wrote this already, that, you know, I do it online, so I get a thing that says I won $8 in the lottery, and I go, boy, there again, I can't win at the lottery. And then I thought I won the best lottery in the world. I was born in America.
Yeah, if you're born in America, you won a wonderful lottery. And yeah, all you have to do is look at those tourists that came over and, you know, hey, Americans are free. Hey, there's law and order here. Hey, we can say things about political people without being afraid of a knock on the door. I mean, this is wonderful freedom. We can get a job. I mean, thank goodness for the United States of America. Happy Independence Day, 250, Paul W.
Oh, God bless you, Patrick. I love you. Thank you so much. Have a great rest of the day.
All right, you too. Bye.
Patrick Anderson, founder and CEO of Anderson Economic Group. He's the best, as are you, at 1:30 on WJR. Well, I don't believe I didn't come up with this because I've heard this line before. Keith Newell sent it, and he said, remember, if you don't go to your friend's funeral, they're not going to go to yours. Just wondering if you were paying attention.
Also, I've heard that before, but it's funny every time.
It is funny when you think about it. It is kind of funny. All right, we needed a little humor there. Now we have Chad Livengood. We haven't talked to Chad in a long time. He's the famous Detroit News political editor, and he is diving into a topic that just made me scratch my head when I heard Ambassador Pete Hoekstra say, it's a myth that Canada paid for the Gordie Howe Bridge. Chad, this is astonishing to me. Good afternoon. Welcome back.
Good afternoon, Paul W. Yeah, I mean, Pete Hoekstra is a career politician. It's not a slight, and it takes some serious fiscal gymnastics to kind of come to this conclusion that Canada isn't borrowing the cost and the financial burden and liability of this $4.7 billion bridge, about $6 billion Canadian. That they are indeed fully on the hook for this thing and have been from the start, and that's not really a new thing, but it's been pretty much set in stone for 14 years now.
When he was on some show and they were talking and he asked, who do you think paid for the bridge? And this one guy said that Canada did. The quote from Hoekstra, that's the big myth that is out there, the funding of the bridge. I think it's important that people realize this. He explained that the Canadian government loaned the Bridge Authority $4.5 billion to $5 billion. So Canada is serving as the bank for the bridge. The expectation is that over the years, as the bridge generates revenue, the bridge will be paid back. So the bridge will actually be paid for by the folks who are using the bridge. It'll not be paid for by the Canadian government. That sounds like such a, frankly, a technicality in terms of people understanding. What we know is we couldn't pay for the bridge for whatever reason, and Canada said we'll pay for the bridge, but we want to take the tolls to pay us back.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is we didn't want to pay for the bridge. I mean, when the bridge debate was going on, almost peel back to like the Great Recession, late second term of Jennifer Granholm, the bill to build the bridge at the time, they said it was going to be $1 billion, so we needed to put $500 million up. They could never get this bill through the state Senate for a variety of reasons. A lot of it was influenced by the Maroon family, owners of the Ambassador Bridge, but also at the time the state was coming out of the Great Recession and people were barely paying the bills to run state government. No one really wanted to go write a check or basically borrow $500 million. So the Canadians came along and said, you know what, we'll do that. We'll put the money up. And then, of course, over time, it's because it took so long, it became $1 billion and then more than that. And then in around 2018, Paul W., you might remember, the federal government, the Obama administration and Congress refused to fund a customs plaza in Detroit in what is essentially was the old Delray neighborhood. This huge plaza for processing of vehicles and checking vehicles and whatnot for contraband. And so the Canadian government said, you know what, we'll pay for that as well. I mean, this all has been charged over to the credit card of Canada. Yes, of course, the users will pay for it, but that's how all bridges work.
Right.
When Michigan built the second span of the Blue Water Bridge in Port Huron to Sarnia, Michigan put the money up, and then Michigan has recouped its cost over time through tolls. Same thing for how we funded the Mackinac Bridge and the International Bridge in Sault Ste. Marie. Any other bridge that requires tolls or any other infrastructure requires tolls, whether it's a tunnel or whatnot, the cost is borne by the users. And ultimately, the government essentially they are the bank because they're the ones that can actually go borrow, billions of dollars. And so this is an interesting tactic by Hoekstra in the middle of this debate over opening this bridge that essentially Hoekstra and his government, the Trump administration, are holding up. They are trying to relitigate who's going to pay for this. And ultimately, It looks more like a diversion for the Ambassador Bridge owner, who continues to be the only game in town with a big bridge that can hold commercial trucks and 7,000 of them cross every day.
Well, I got to tell you, I was like the lone voice in the wind back then because I said it would be significantly over budget, and I said it would be significantly later than originally forecast. All those things are completely true, which is why I said at the time, hey, if the Maroons want to build the bridge at their expense, out of their pocket, they know how to run bridges, let them do it. And I don't feel any less that I still think that would have been a better case. And I didn't even foresee this kind of an argument. Well, Canada didn't really pay for the bridge. I mean, I never even saw that one coming. But I still think I was against the idea that the state of Michigan was going to take on the responsibility of anything that was billions of dollars when somebody in the private sector said they would do it.
Yep. Well, at the end of the day, the Canadians didn't want a second Maroon-owned bridge landing on their land, and they wanted their own bridge. And this is had a lot to do with the acrimony over the years between the Canadians and the Maroons. It also has a lot to do with the fact that the Ambassador Bridge was built in the 20s, a couple decades before the invention of the super freeways of the U.S. and Canada, and it wasn't designed for the kind of truck traffic that goes through multiple stoplights on here on Church Street in Windsor. They wanted to build something that was separate from town, that had a connector to the to the Ontario 401 freeway. They built this Herb Gray Parkway, this billion-dollar highway to connect the two. It's been sitting there, Paul W., for 10 years waiting for this bridge to be built, named after Herb Gray, who was kind of like the John Dingo of Windsor, of politicians over across the river. And so this is all part of a very, very long, lengthy saga that has gone on with the Detroit River Bridge Wars, and yet another chapter is just continuing to be written as we're waiting around for this new span to open.
Leave it to Chad Livengood, award-winning Detroit News political editor. Thanks for summing all this up for us very well, Chad. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, sir.
144 at WJR. I know he gets a trial with his peers in the jury box and all this other stuff, but what a waste of time and money. This Robinson is as guilty as sin. Just from the texts that went back and forth between Robinson, the Charlie Kirk assassin, clearly, he admits it in the text, takes full credit for doing it, to his lover, Twiggs, I guess. He confesses the whole thing. It's astonishing to me. And this is just so that the judge will then decide that there's enough evidence for this guy to go to trial. Doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of coverage for a preliminary trial.
Yeah. And just from what I'm not even paying that close attention, and I don't have the audio on, but just from what I just saw on their cell phones and the conversation they had, he admits doing it.
Right.
He was not going to take any more of Charlie Kirk's hate. You know, I never even knew who Charlie Kirk was until all this happened.
You know, Danielle and I were talking about this. I think that Charlie Kirk was well known before he was shot, but I think that he's become even more well known after.
Oh, he's without question more well known because there are a lot of us who'd never heard of him. He was well known among a younger group of people who felt that he spoke their language and on behalf of the country and all of that. Well, I had no idea who he was, but even for the life of me, after hearing all of these haters, and there were many, I haven't done it lately, but right after it happened, all of these people talking about hate, I'd go online looking to try to find this hate they would talk about, and I never found it. I found him challenging people, but I didn't find this just rip-roaring hate. He would disagree with people. He would get in conversations, even arguments with people. But I never saw this overwhelming hate these people all talk about. Did you?
And we've said it before. I mean, Charlie Kirk did not deserve anything that happened to him. But, I mean, part of his stock in trade was confrontation and getting into spirited discussions and, you know, trying to make liberals look stupid and stuff. But, again, nothing justifies what happened to him. But, you know, his stock in trade was being controversial and confrontational.
But I saw him arguing with people. I saw him challenging people. But they were, to me, they were mostly what I saw. Highly spirited, but yet still respectful arguments,
yeah,
there, I guess is one way of putting
yeah,
it.
Yeah, there were some videos I would watch, and even if I didn't agree with Charlie Kirk, I said, okay, well, you know, he came across likable in that. And there's others like, okay, I mean, all he's trying to do is start arguments for, you know, for clicks. But, yeah, I mean, there were some interesting civil discussions he would have, and other times he would get into loud arguing matches with folks.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But as you said, and it goes without saying, but these days you have to say it, he certainly didn't deserve
right.
what he got.
Right.
Did you know, we've never had I have not followed FIFA, and they say football, I say soccer. I've not followed it until we were in it, and it was a big deal, and it was great, and
right,
it was exciting,
here.
And it was sad that it ended the way it did. But there's never been a FIFA World Cup final halftime show. But they can't help themselves. They've come to America. And in America, we have halftime shows, even if there isn't a halftime.
Right.
So
usually they're just having some oranges or something.
Yeah, but now there's going to be a halftime show that we can all either embrace or criticize, because that's what we do. This is a halftime show where Michigan will be represented by
really?
Madonna.
Oh, Madonna's going to be in it.
Madonna is good. It might be sponsored by AARP. I don't know. Madonna is currently on the AARP tour, as would I be had I been out there touring, but... So, as I understand it right now, it's Madonna, Justin Bieber, Shakira, and BTS.
Wow.
That's very inclusive, except for Madonna's so old that when she did the Super Bowl halftime show, she barely moved. So I guess they're going to plant her on stage and everyone else is going to do all the work.
It was up with people when she did the Super Bowl halftime show. Well, that's interesting.
You guys are deadly.
You've got the three host countries, of course, Madonna, Justin Bieber, and, well, not Shakira's from Central America, so okay. Never mind.
All right.
That's in America.
Sounded good as you said it. And remind me who BTS is.
They are a Japanese group, or Korean group, yeah.
Okay. Obviously, they're very hot.
They're part of the K-pop.
Oh, the K-pop.
They're more Revolution. They're more popular worldwide than they are in America. I mean, they've had some hits here, but they're
kind of like football.
Right.
JR Afternoon with Ryan Ermani. And Marie Osborne is in for Ryan. And I know, Marie, you've got a great show planned.
Well, we hope so. We work hard at that for you.
I know you do.
So, yeah, we've got lots of things. We're going to talk a little bit today about Erica Kirk. You were talking about the trial that's going on, the preliminary hearing, I should say, out in Utah.
Yeah.
But she's trying to get some information that's been held back from the public. She's trying to get that released. We're going to talk more about that.
She wants it all out there. She says,
can't blame her.
That should all be out there. Why are they not doing that? I'm telling you, I said earlier, I am worried that this judge could be the next Judge Ito. Remember from
please don't
Lance
even mention
Ito.
That.
Was it Lance
yes,
Ito?
Yes, don't even mention that.
Well, I'm sorry.
To this day, people still talk about that. Yep.
We got to run. Stand by for news and Marie Osborne. Regards, Paul W. Smith.